Peace has broken out in the Middle East again, but this time not with Iran, but with Hamas. Germany has been rocked by another terrorist attack, and this one might lead to more change than some of the previous ones. Russia and China are standing side by side militarily, and we'll look at some of the latest revelations about COVID from the man that it made a celebrity on today's Trumpet World. Congratulations to all on this amazing development that everybody said could not be achieved. That was Donald Trump posting on Truth Social this week, celebrating the latest ceasefire. So we're joined now by our Middle East correspondent, Mihailo Zekic. Mihailo, what was this all about? And have you broken out the champagne?
Well, I don't need an excuse for that. Yesterday, the president announced the complete disarmament of Hamas. For people that have followed our program long, they would know that this has been the big sticking point among many sticking points, but this is the biggest that has stopped this eternal peace from coming to Israel and to Gaza, from finally bringing Israelis and Palestinians together. And Hamas has finally agreed to it due to the infinite wisdom of the President of the United States, and now there's nothing but sunny ways going ahead. I, of course, speak as a fool. Under the agreement, at least according to sources with the Telegraph, quote, Hamas would first hand over its heavy weapons to a transitional Palestinian body to be stored and decommissioned. The deal leaves the surrender of personal weapons until last, end quote. So, in other words, Hamas has to give its weapons to other Palestinians who will keep it in Gaza for an indeterminate amount of time that Hamas can determine what the goalposts actually are, and that counts as disarmament, according to the president. This is not that different from all of the counterproposals Hamas has been proposing to this point, that, well, if we can take our soldiers and convert them into police, but they can still keep their weapons, then problem solved, right? That didn't fly. So now they're saying, well, if we keep the weapons in Gaza, but we physically don't have our hands on them, and we drag it out as long as possible with determining on what weapon counts as what different type, then that counts as disarmament too. And President Trump has taken the bait. The big question is, why now? As bad as this looks for President Trump, this is probably the biggest quote-unquote concession Hamas has agreed to this point.
So basically, Hamas will take its weapons, give them to some other terrorists. I mean, really, they're all pretty much terrorists in Gaza, vast majority, and say, hang on to these. And Israel is expected to retreat from Gaza. And according to the deal, after Israel's retreated, then those weapons will not be given back to Hamas. They'll be destroyed. And Israel has to just trust that those weapons will be destroyed, which, very bad deal for Israel. And it does seem like this, like the Telegraph piece kind of brought this out. It feels like it could fall apart almost instantly. The International Stabilization Force is not in place. There's not enough troops that have been, like other countries that have come in and committed to that. So to me, this is the most disturbing part of this, is that Donald Trump is coming out and is so optimistic about that. I mean, I should point out that we are recording this at 9 o'clock in the morning for Mihailo. So hopefully, he's not been drinking champagne at this early hour. But you know, that to this kind of congratulatory, yes, this is amazing, we've done a great deal, I think that's really worrying. And I think it's all the more worrying when you do have this history of failed deals. You know, the January deal, when he took office, January 2025, and President Trump announced a ceasefire with Iran. And then autumn of 2025, he announced a ceasefire. I mean, sorry, ceasefire with Hamas. Autumn 2025, ceasefire with Hamas. We've had the ceasefires with Iran and various stages there. Like, he keeps negotiating with terrorists and it keeps not working. And yet, there's the deal here with so many obvious problems, and he still thinks it's going to work. Like, what isn't he getting here?
Well, that's the thing. I don't think he's ignorant of how, like, that Hamas doesn't have the best interests of everybody at heart. I think he knows at this point that them, that the Iranians, that this terror network isn't actually interested in peace. But accepting the realities on the ground doesn't win you any popularity points at home. It doesn't give you a big flashy piece of paper that you can help, that can help you boost your ratings on coming up ahead of midterms. And this has been, we've spoken plenty of times about how Barack Obama and Joe Biden have twisted Israel's arm. Really, every president trying to work out the Middle East peace process has always seen Israel as the weaker partner. And if you want to get something that'll grab headlines, Israel is the easier half of the two to pressure to accept that. And it reminds me of a prophecy in Hosea 5 verse 13 that we've spoken of plenty. Have you had a program recently on our Wednesday show about this verse? It reads, when Ephraim saw his sickness and Judah saw his wound, then went Ephraim to the Assyrian and sent to King Jareb, yet could he not heal you nor cure you of your wound. And as our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, writes in his book, The Jerusalem Prophecy, it has more details about this, that this is talking about Israel, the state of Israel, the Jews in the Middle East, I mean, seeing that they have a wound with the Palestinian peace process. That word wound, it actually means a remedy or a bandage, and they're seeing that everything they try to do to fix the wound is not working. And I think it's interesting, just looking at this verse, this is me speaking, the inference is that Judah goes to the Assyrian after he sees the wound. Mr. Fleury's talked about this as well. In other words, the wound is continuing to fester, it's continuing not to be healed, and then it goes to the Assyrian, to Germany, which you will talk about in a later segment. Which implies that Israel gets fed up with the way things have been going with the peace process at this point. It gets tired of same old, and it starts shopping for new international partners. This kind of what we just saw here with Gaza, what we've been seeing since President Trump took back office and before that, is all giving more and more straws on the camel's back to finally get fed up and start rejecting the U.S. as a peacemaker. And I don't think it's a stretch to imagine this could cause, if unaddressed, a big rupture in Israel-U.S. relations down the road.
Yeah, and certainly Israel is going to see that these various peace deals are not working. I think perhaps maybe the bigger thing is what this says about the United States. And it does bring right back some things that Mr. Fleury wrote in January 2025, or it was in our March 2025 Trumpet print edition, right after President Trump announced this ceasefire. He also made some comments in a Key of David program. And here's a bold forecast that he gave in that.
There is this victory, almost victory, that suddenly now they have lost the war with the Gaza terrorists, and they're going to have to be living beside them forever, it looks like. They were there to destroy the Hamas terrorists, and now the opposite happened. What are we to do with that? But I'll tell you this, what Mr. Trump has done here is going to plague him from the very beginning to the end of his tenure in office. That is a fact, that, and you wait and see if it doesn't happen that way, unless there's a big change in what he's doing. He has disgraced Netanyahu, and it's just a catastrophe that it's hard to even describe.
And that was a pretty specific forecast that this would plague President Trump throughout his presidency. And we've seen him. What is his biggest problem right now? It's a failed peace deal with Iran, and the fact that the Strait of Hormuz is closed, and oil prices are high, and he can't seem to finish this war. It's plaguing him, this same approach. And it really is the same approach. It's a lack of will to confront problems. And again, Mr. Fleury made that point in this Key of David.
Here you have a man fighting and winning like nobody has in the Middle East for quite some time, as Netanyahu was. And here he has the will to fight for his nation in a war. And that's the kind of ally you need if he's going to fight for freedom. And there may be political differences in that, but this is not politics. This is about winning a war for all politicians. And that certainly is what Israel is facing right now. It is a nightmare, and it's a colossal tragedy. But what we see in the Jewish state right now, it's kind of the ultimate fight. And their nation and its survival depends on it. Fight, or die as a nation. That's what it's all about. And America has lost the Middle East as far as having a certain amount of power there. We don't anymore.
It's an unwillingness to fight, an unwillingness to grapple with the hard problems. And so he reaches for something that he knows has failed. I mean, this will sound odd because it's like a completely different story. And I'm sure Andrew will bring this up when we talk to him later. But it reminds me a bit of Mandami's grocery stores. Like, let's solve poverty in New York by having state-run grocery stores. This has failed everywhere else that we've tried it. This is obviously going to fail if you just think through the logic of opening up grocery stores, subsidizing by the taxpayer, having them be 30% cheaper than anywhere else. So everyone goes there to buy their food, which then costs the taxpayer a lot of money, puts other stores out of business. It is very clearly going to be a disaster, and we've done it before and it's been a disaster. But for a socialist, it's like either do this or ask hard questions. Ask questions about, you know, do hard things. Really have to grapple with fundamental causes. That's hard. So let's treat the effects with the grocery stores. And it's kind of the same thing. Defeating Hamas properly is hard. Defeating Iran properly is hard. Like, nobody's saying this is going to be easy and that there's just a button that Donald Trump can press to do it overnight. Now, certainly when you confront things with God's help, often they do end up being easier than you'd feared, easier than you'd built up this obstacle to be in your mind. But, you know, yeah, these are genuine difficulties that he's grappling with. But rather than do the hard things, it's like, okay, well, let's try a peace deal. Again, it's failed all these other times, but we don't like the alternative, so we'll just try it again, and it's going to fail. And these, you know, why do we have these repeated peace deals? It is a symptom of this complete lack of will. I mean, Mr. Flurry, when he wrote about it in the Trumpet print, he said, "We must recognize this deal for what it is, a disturbing sign of America's lost power in the Middle East, a red flag about the president's approach to international affairs, a warning about the reliability of America's alliance with Israel, and a terrible harbinger of far worse curses to come in both nations." And he was writing that in January of 2025, the first month of President Trump's new term in office. Second term in office. And it's exactly what we've seen from then on out. You could see it in that one approach to that one peace treaty, or Mr. Flurry could, with that biblical, Bible-based analysis. And we just see it plague his time in office throughout there. And that article that he wrote, that we've got that in, that is called "President Trump Betrayed Israel." A strong article. Maybe it looked too strong at the time, but time has absolutely vindicated it. That's from our March 2025 issue, which, like I said, we work a month or two ahead. It was written right around January. So much there that explains what's been going on in Israel and President Trump's mistakes, and shows where we need to get to the cause of, well, why do we have a lack of will? Why won't we confront our problems? And the solution to that, the way to build that will, well, that is to repent. That broken will is a curse for disobedience. and getting back to God, getting back to his way of the way that he says to worship, not the way that we think we want to do it, the way that he says to build families. Well, that's going to build strong leaders, a strong next generation, but we have to do it the way he says, not according to our own ideas. That's the solution, really. And that's you're talking about confronting Iran, confronting our own sins, repentance. That is hard. No leader wants to come to the nation with a message of repentance. I don't know if any president has done that since Abraham Lincoln. That's what America needs. Mihailo, we touched on Hormuz just now. There have been a lot of important developments in the Iran war as well. What else can you bring to us from the Middle East?
Well, Wednesday, an Iranian drone struck an Egyptian port facility on the Mediterranean side of the Suez Canal. Two ships, including an American ship, a merchant ship, caught fire. Anonymous Iranian sources were telling the New York Times that this was a warning shot, that if you think with everything with going on with Hormuz, everything with going on with the Houthis, if you think that's bad, if you think oil prices are bad now, we have the capability to cause even more chaos and more maritime oil choke points. And apart from maybe sporadic drone or missile attacks, we expect the Suez Canal and even the nation of Egypt as a whole to become completely under Iranian influence because of a prophecy in Daniel 11. We have a Trends article called Why the Trumpet Watches Iran Allying with Egypt that describes that. Also on Wednesday, the United States and Saudi Arabia launched joint airstrikes against the Shiite militias in Iraq. These are the terror groups that are nominally part of the Iraqi military, but really get their marching orders from Iran as part of their axis of resistance. These strikes are the first public joint strikes between the two countries we've seen in the war. It's in response to these same militias attacking Saudi Arabia. I think that goes to show just how much America has entwined itself with Saudi Arabia, a country that's prophesied to not be a good partner, to say the least, in the long run. We spoke about that last week. I also thought it was interesting at the funeral of some of these Iraqi terrorists that were killed, their coffins were draped in Iranian flags, not Iraqi flags, which shows, I think, just how much Iran has gotten control of that country. That's a long-standing prediction Mr. Fleury made back when Saddam Hussein was in power, that Iran would get control of Iraq. That would have seemed ridiculous in the 1990s, but nobody would dispute that today.
Thank you for that, Mihailo. Well, it's not just Israel that terrorists strike. Germany was hit by a shocking terrorist attack this week. One person was killed and 29 injured after an Islamist terrorist drove a van through a crowd in Berlin on Saturday night. These kind of car rammings have sadly become common in Germany. Usually the media is pretty quick to move on, and it's very much, you know, nothing to see here. Let's not make a big deal about it. This week, looking at the German media, the response to this one was quite a bit bigger. And a big part of the reason why, I think, is because the target was a homosexual pride parade. You know, if it's a church that's attacked, if it's a Christmas market, well, they value diversity above their Christian heritage, or at least many in the mainstream media do. I don't think the public does, and certainly not just a lot of other people in Europe. But those are the media priorities. When it hits a pride parade, well, that's a strike against diversity, their biggest god, their religion. And so they've made a much, much bigger deal out of this attack. So here's what happened. At 10 p.m., a white van drove into a crowd near this pride celebration that was close to Brandenburg Gate in the heart of Germany's capital. The driver hit several people. He crashed into a tree. He got out and fled on foot. There are some reports saying that he drew a knife or a machete and started stabbing those around him as he fled. And then the next day, the police announced that their main suspect was 21-year-old Abdul Balout. And then later that day on Sunday, the police shot Balout as they tried to arrest him. Now, he had clear links to Islamist terrorism, and it is crazy to me that he was even free and just able to carry out this attack. Like, it just seems so obviously irresponsible of the German justice system, the German politicians that designed the justice system. It is crazy. So Balot, he was born in Germany. He holds German citizenship. His mother is from Lebanon. A couple of years ago, he posted Islamic State propaganda on Instagram in May of 2025. He went to Lebanon. His plan was to cross into Syria and join Islamic State. You know, he wanted to sign up as a terrorist fighting in Syria. Instead, the Lebanese authorities arrested him. He was sentenced to 3 months in prison. He was released. He came back to Germany. He was arrested at the airport. Okay, so far, so good. That is kind of, I mean, you'd want him to be deported, really, but you would want the authorities to pick him up when he arrived. In May of this year, he was sentenced to nearly 2 years in prison for, quote, preparing a serious act of violence endangering the state. So the court said, you are guilty. We acknowledge that you are guilty of endangering the state. You are a danger to Germany. Therefore, we're going to let you go for 6 months before your jail sentence starts. Like, what? Why? So they deferred the sentence for 6 months. Like, it's not just that I disagree with the decision. I cannot see any possible rationale that enables you to reach this decision of saying, this guy is dangerous for the state. He needs to be locked up, but we're going to release him for 6 months first. What do you expect him to do? So he comes out and carries out this attack. He gets a van, drives it into people. I mean, this is an attack that is very hard to stop. You know, Europe has cracked down on guns. Then they've cracked down on knives. You know, it's to the point now that Boy Scouts get arrested for carrying around a knife. I mean, there's lots of knife crime, but I also think it's just bonkers that you can't carry a knife around. But how do you control for car attacks? Very, very difficult. And so you've had a series of these attacks. The first happened in 2016, or one of the first big ones in Germany, when an Islamist terrorist killed 11 people driving a truck into a Christmas market. I think you had other big vehicle attacks in France. You had 6 killed and over 200 injured in 2024 when a Saudi national drove into a Christmas market. Most recent attacks you had in March 2025, May this year. Those appear to have been carried out by mentally ill Germans with no links to Islamic terror. But you've had about 10 Islamic ramming attacks in France and the United Kingdom since 2007. But like I said, this one, unlike a lot of the others that they've tried to sweep under the carpet, this one is gaining traction. Friedrich Merz, he posted on X, what a heinous act in Berlin. This is an attack on our society. Now, I said it's gotten a lot of attention. I mean, still a lot of the response since then has been kind of nonsensical. The major push that the Social Democrats, the German equivalent of the Democratic Party, they're part of the ruling coalition, they want to respond to this attack by changing the German constitution to outlaw discrimination against homosexuals, like to make sexual orientation a protected characteristic. I think there's lots to disagree with there, but also this would have nothing to do with this guy would not have said, oh, I'm not going to drive my bus or my van into a crowd of people because actually the German constitution says that I can't discriminate against homosexuals. I'll go find a heterosexual crowd to drive in. That's kind of insane. But the thing is, Germans see this too. You know, they see that insane decisions led up to this. The leaders are still making crazy decisions. This is going to lead to a big change within German society. And another more recent story from this week, I think, also ties right into this, where Spain is finding themselves overrun with migrants. So they've got a little enclave on North Africa. And recently, Spanish court, you know, there's a big warning for America here. This is what happens when courts start making nonsensical warnings on immigration. The court ruled if somebody climbs over the wall from Africa into this enclave, you can just send them back. They don't need an immigration hearing. They don't need an appeal. You know, all of these things take months because they can keep appealing and manufacturing different reasons of why they need asylum. If they climb over the wall, you don't need that. You can send them back to Africa. Now, if that happened in Mexico, European leaders would go ballistic. They'd say, you know, this is Nazism, etc. But that's the rule. But the court ruled and said, if they come by sea, if they swim around the wall instead of climbing over the wall, it's different. If they swim around the wall, you can't send them back. I don't know, maybe a swimming migrant is more beneficial to Spanish society than a climbing migrant. But if they swim, they can stay. And they've got all of this multi-years-long appeal process that they can go through before being deported. Generally, they'll have escaped and moved to some other European country by now. So the court making this decision led to a massive influx of migrants trying to get into Spain. And so you had this kind of mass run on the border taking place over the last few days. I think 1,500 migrants have tried to come into this little enclave of Ceuta, coming round by sea. Reception centers have collapsed. About 20 people, the last figure I saw, have died in this. And you've had, well, Italy is, Spain has been a soft touch on migration for quite a while now. And so Spain has come out, and or Italy has come out and said, well, we need to kick Spain out of the Schengen Agreement. We need to suspend their participation in this free open border zone, because we're just going to keep having these migrants. They're going to end up in Italy. They're going to end up spread all over Europe. So they're worried about this. A lot of this, because these migrants, if they allowed into Spain, they can then travel very easily all around Europe. This is very worrying to all of Europe. So you've got a lot of Muslim migrants, you've got a lot of Muslim terrorist attacks, you've got governments completely failing to deal with both, having crazy policies when it comes to both of them. And the only groups that are making any sense in so many of these are groups like the Alternative for Deutschland in Germany, that are putting forward some common sense ways of dealing with these real problems. And these groups... groups like the Alternative for Deutschland, you've got a lot of people in there that glorify their Nazi history, that say, well, the Nazis were great. We're unfairly maligned. All they were doing was trying to stand up for German culture the way that we're doing. We need to be proud of what Germany achieved in World War I and World War II. One of their leaders said that. So because all the mainstream parties won't take any common sense ways of dealing with the problem, well, people are being pushed to these extreme parties. After the 2016 attack, Mr. Brad McDonald had a Trumpet article. He said, Merkel's failure to react more energetically to the Berlin attack, her failure to recognize the extent of the problems and the part her policies played in creating it, and her failure to take the German public concerns seriously are deeply alarming. The more, and then he's a bit further down, the more disillusioned, frustrated, and angry the German people become, the more vulnerable they will be to radical politics and radical leaders with radical solutions. That is where all of Europe is getting to now. They're ready to embrace radical leaders with radical solutions. I mean, it's gotten to the point, another story today showed... that only 17% believe that the German state is capable of fulfilling its responsibilities. Most Germans think, like, not just a small majority, overwhelming majority of Germans think that their government can't just do its basic responsibilities, is completely failing. This is going to lead to the rise of a very different Germany, not just the election of a different party. They look at how much the mainstream has tried to back some of these crazy policies like migration. It's not just a political party. It is the judicial system. And they've passed all kinds of rulings, and they've put things in, or they've interpreted things in constitutional law, in international law, in like UN conventions on refugees, the European Court of Human Rights, the European Convention on Human Rights, so that even if you have a different democratic party, it would be very difficult for them to do anything about this. They've created a massive problem, and they've made it just about impossible to solve democratically. European democracy will not survive this. It's going to lead to the rise of a strongman. They'll bring that in rather than have their countries destroyed by these kind of attacks and this kind of decline. And watch this, that's where it's leading in Germany. The rise of a strong German leader. And when we've got a lot of sin, a lot of family breakdown, and a lot of pride parades in Israel, you've got that in Germany too. And you know, that kind of sin, that's something that Satan the devil, that Jesus Christ talked about a lot. He can take advantage of that. And he can take advantage of that in Britain and in America to bring these nations down, to punish them with economic collapse, with conquest, with invasion. He's going to use that in Germany as well to bring to power a strongman. And they'll suffer the consequences, or they'll suffer from that as well. So it's going to lead to keep watching the rise of a strong leader. And a lot of people are becoming more and more dissatisfied with Friedrich Merz. He's got a few elections coming up just in September. If he does badly there, he could be gone by the end of the year. You could have a strong man in Germany come to power very quickly. We've had this. Mr. Armstrong's talked about this. Mr. Flurry's talked about this. I mean, we can play. We've got a montage we can play from the Key of David, where Mr. Flurry's talked about the rise of this strong leader.
Now, he's not going to come in by, let's say, a democratic process. He's going to come in and use flatteries and sort of tweak the democratic process, it says here, something like that, and perhaps take advantage of a weak coalition. But he's going to come in by flatteries. So God sees him, well, not the same way the people see him, but he actually gains that power, hijacks that European superpower by flatteries. He apparently puts together some kind of a small coalition, and that's how he moves into power. I mean, he is unusually adept at flattery. You have to be very intelligent to be able to deceive people in high places with that, with flattery. And he does it magnificently. Well, he was never voted into the office, but he came in, got control of all that power through deceit and flatteries. Now, remember, this is an end-time book, and this is an end-time prophecy. It's going to happen again in this end time. A man is going to come, and through deceit and flatteries, is going to get control of the Holy Roman Empire and its 10 toes or 10 kings, and not by voting, even though that is their system today. It is not going to, he's going to come in another way.
So keep watching for this strong leader. The Bible says he's going to come. A strong German leader is imminent is a booklet that we've got that will take you through those biblical scriptures. We'll show you how passages in Daniel chapter 8 apply to right now. They'll show you where Jesus Christ confirms, yes, this is a passage that is talking about what is happening today. You know, Jesus Christ himself has said, well, watch for these prophecies in the book of Daniel to be fulfilled in the future. And a strong man rising in Europe is a core part of that, ruling this king, European king of the north. So keep watching those political changes in Germany. Some other important stories from Europe this week. Germany ranked number one for anti-Semitic incidents, according to a report released by the J7 Lager Communities Task Force Against Anti-Semitism. This is something that Israel and the Jews really do need to pay a lot of attention to, because in a lot of ways, Germany does look like Israel's best friend right now. They are at least standing up to European initiatives to basically put trade embargoes on Israel, to not sell them weapons. They look like a good friend. Well, this report, where you've got a lot of anti-Semitism and abuse, it's happening around the world. It is certainly not just a German problem by any stretch of the imagination. But it's a problem in Germany too. Well, yeah, that's an important story to watch and something that should wake up. That should wake up Israel. You've got a split last week in Poland's Law and Justice Party, where you've got the former prime ministers kind of led one faction out away from the longtime party leader. And this party has been one of the strongest opponents to Germany and German domination of Europe. They have spoken out very powerfully on that. Germany played a major role in evicting them from government just a couple of years ago. And so now with this party split, well, their power is greatly reduced. This could give Germany more power within Europe. And then I mentioned Friedrich Merz having challenges. Another came from just political reshuffles. He tried to reshuffle his cabinet gradually over the week. It comes because, I think I mentioned this last time, Jens Spahn, the parliamentary leader of the Christian Democratic and Christian Social Unions, he and his homosexual partner have tried to buy a baby through surrogacy, and there was outcry at that. He was pushed out. And just the longer this reshuffle has gone on, and it's taken him quite a few days, the more and more unpopular it's become, the more leaders have publicly criticized him. And it's not looking good for Friedrich Merz. And you can see that there's a push for a strong leader, or there will be a strong leader coming soon to Germany. Well, we've spent a lot of time on this show in recent weeks, and even on the show so far today, talking about maritime choke points, strategic sea gates. Bible prophecy told us what would happen to them. They'd be controlled by the United States and Britain. We'd lose them. And then our enemies would use these same sea gates to shut us out, to use them against us. And we've seen that happen already in just a small way with what's been going on in Iran and the Middle East. Much worse is coming, and Russia and China are going to play an important role in that. And we saw them taking an important step towards that just this week. So to get the latest on that, we'll go to our Asia correspondent, Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, that's right. Russia and China concluded a joint naval patrol this week that really strengthens their combined ability to dominate the world's critical sea lanes, some of them at least, and to project military force far from their own shores. This patrol started all the way back on July 13th off the coast of China's Shandong province, and for 17 days, these Russian and Chinese warships sailed through several strategic straits. They passed through the Miyako Strait, the Edorofu, and also the Soya. They also passed through key parts of the Western Pacific and the Sea of Okhotsk, and also the Sea of Japan. It took them 17 days to complete the full mission, as I said, and throughout all of it, they were carrying out joint exercises, learning how to essentially just better make war together, including a whole range of maritime boarding operations and counterterrorism drills, and also helicopter landings on each other's vessels and things like that. These drills included what they called maritime inspection exercises as well. That's basically practicing how to intercept and board other nations' vessels. So the navies of Russia and China spent all this time patrolling some of the world's most strategic waters and just actively training, deepening their military cooperation. You know, they were not just sailing their warships side by side, but rehearsing how to dominate the world's sea lanes and how to assert their will far from their own shores. So it is a significant development, showing still more evidence of this tremendously powerful and deep military partnership that Russia and China are building. And this is something that the trumpet regularly reports on, because prophecy warns us that a colossal Asian force will emerge in the modern era, and it shows that it will really shake the world. There are even specific warnings showing that this force will use its naval power to take over critical sea gates and block the U.S. and some of its allies out of vital areas, and eventually even join other naval powers to conduct a besiegement, just a massive besiegement of America and some of its allies. You can see that in Isaiah 23 and Ezekiel 27 as well. Those passages are about what is called a mart of nations, just a very deep economic alliance that will form between not just Russia and China, but also with European nations. And when you put those passages alongside Deuteronomy 28, verse 52, it's clear that this economic alliance will come together mostly to besiege the United States and some of its allies and just block them out of being able to use a lot of the critical sea lanes and gates around the world and really block them out of world trade. So it's an extremely momentous outcome that these naval patrols are leading to. It's far more than just some kind of routine patrols that are meant to, you know, practice just pedestrian operations. It's really about these nations preparing to make war together and to do it specifically in a way that will counter the current global order. And we have an article, it's called Storming America's Castle, and it takes a close look at these different passages and puts current events in the context of them to show where this is all leading. Once again, that's called Storming America's Castle, and it shows that there's also a lot of hope tied into these developments. So I hope you'll check that out if you haven't yet. Once again, Storming America's Castle.
Thank you for that, Jeremiah. Yeah, I think this is a really interesting story, mostly for everything that you mentioned. I think there's a couple of other interesting points about it. One, to see these two navies working together, like they do complement each other quite well. Like China, a massive new naval power, outputting boats at a tremendous rate, huge amount of investment, but not a massively experienced naval power. You know, maybe 500 years ago, you had one or two impressive Chinese admirals. But in modern history, in the last 200 years, you know, they've not really been a naval power. They've only even operated nuclear aircraft carriers in very recent history. I mean, Russia doesn't have the naval tradition of, say, America, Britain, or Japan. But they have all of that Cold War history of operating aircraft carriers and operating at a scale that China just hasn't. But their aircraft carrier is kind of old and decrepit and has to be accompanied by a towboat or a tugboat because it can and does break down very often. They don't have the same dynamite. So it's like Russia can come and I think bring a certain naval tradition and legacy and experience to the table. And China has a lot of the newer ships and the shiny new ships, but then maybe not the experience in using them. So I think that's really interesting to see that dynamic. That the two, there is, I think, a genuine synergy there that is often rare in alliances where the two of them are probably more powerful than the sum of their parts combined. And then I think the other point of that I find interesting too is, like, fighting at a maritime choke point is different to deep sea fighting. And this kind of gets into some of the debates about how naval warfare has changed. But so much of naval warfare is built around aircraft carriers because you can have a huge amount of power that can be thousands of miles away from land and just hard to reach, hard to get to. Hard to find in recent decades in the age of satellite technology. Maybe that's over and that might massively diminish the power of aircraft carriers, but still hard to reach, hard to get to. That changes at a maritime choke point. You know, an aircraft carrier doesn't have an easier time coming through the Suez Canal than any other ship. And in fact, is probably much harder to get through. It's just bigger. So you've got a point where America's biggest naval assets are most vulnerable, and this is where Russia and China are actively practicing attacking. I mean, this is, if you're the junior, the underdog, or in China's case, kind of the up-and-coming power, and you're taking on the established one, closing choke points is kind of the strategy that you'd use, and it's prophesied, and they're practicing doing that. So I think that's a really fascinating aspect of this that you brought us.
Yes, I agree. I think it's a very significant development for many reasons, and it's a story that we'll continue to closely watch.
So what else? We missed you last week. What else do you have for us from the Asia region?
Yes, well, first up, a quick one here about China's robot army. The Chinese, like many nations around the world right now, they're watching their population shrink, and they're watching just a great graying of their people, where the average age just keeps going up and the workforce keeps on declining. So Chinese companies such as Unitree are making thousands of humanoid robots every year, soon to be tens of thousands. And they market these robots as the ideal workforce for factories and warehouses and shops and cafes and hospitals and nursing homes and even households, you know, to help with laundry and cleaning and cooking and all kinds of things that people would like to outsource, especially as they age. So this technology, it is rapidly improving, and China presents it as a solution to those shrinking workforces and aging populations, not just for China, but for all kinds of nations. They want to sell these robots to any country around the world that would like to buy them. But on Wednesday, the U.S. Federal Communications Commission banned Chinese robots from entering the U.S. market. The announcement said that these robots, quote, collect data that could be leveraged by malign actors to surveil Americans, enhance the capabilities of foreign intelligence services, or to remotely commandeer the robots. End quote. So it is good to see some precautions taken against the Chinese there. This ban, I think, is a wise precaution. But the truth is, this ban barely scratches the surface of China's sophisticated and relentless campaign to infiltrate America and to compromise its people in any way they can, and to siphon off U.S. data and technology and trade secrets. You know, we've seen the Chinese wage this campaign in many different ways. The robots are just the latest aspect of it. And the Chinese are already really aggressively pushing back against this ban, just labeling it as an outrage that they will fight against in every way they can. And so we will continue to report on this story as well as it develops. And then the last story that I wanted to mention is about China's drones. Drones, of course, are everywhere these days with more and more military applications. This is one of the major results of Russia's war on Ukraine. Nations around the world are seeing that the nature of warfare is dramatically changing in the modern era, and many aspects of it, more and more aspects of it, are being carried out with drones. So the Chinese, of course, are well aware of this, and a huge part of the innovations that are being made with drones are led by China. And this week we learned that China is now building its first dedicated high-altitude drone research center. This is in Tibet. So this facility is specifically about developing drones that operate in extreme conditions, such as those in the Himalayas. And they're designing drones that can carry out all sorts of logistics and various other military operations there. So it shows that China is making remarkable advancements in this critical field and improving its ability to assert power even over some of the most challenging terrain on Earth.
Thank you for that. And your story as well about Chinese infrastructure, that reminds me of, or Chinese robotics being banned from the United States. One I saw from Israel this week, where the United States is trying to get Israel to buy less from China. I think it's their train system, or there's a lot of trains they're looking at buying from China. But it did remind me, just being there, it is really noticeable in Israel and the Middle East how much that they buy from China, and how much, like, just the shelves, the cars, especially things like security cameras, the electronics, a lot more from China than even Europe, let alone the United States. So this is something that China is using all around the world. And I think America is doing a poor job at standing up to it, but there are a lot of countries that are doing a whole lot worse of a job. And that is something that's going to lead to them developing a lot of power. Well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. As we go to the US now, we're going to talk about some of the latest revelations about COVID. And no, I did not accidentally pick up my set of notes from 6 years ago. I do think it's kind of amazing that this was such a huge part of our lives for so long, and we don't really have that much to say about COVID anymore. Like, we really have moved on and barely go back and talk about what went on there. But Dr. Fauci, very much in the news this week with his diary, appearing before Congress. To tell us more about that, we'll go to our U.S. correspondent, Andrew Miller.
Yeah, it is amazing how long ago the COVID pandemic seems. There was like so many months of just like lockdowns and masks and people losing their job for refusing to get the vaccine. And now that's all gone away. And I think a lot of the people responsible for the COVID pandemic, responsible for the draconian lockdowns and the vaccine rollout, definitely like it this way. They want us to be moving on because there is actually been, even in mainstream media, like a paradigm shift that was highlighted this week on how we view everything that happened back then. So if your memory is long enough to think back about 6 years ago, Dr. Anthony Fauci, he was like the darling of the media, Mr. Science himself, the man who was guiding the world through this pandemic with his knowledge and his expertise. Anyone who claimed that the vaccine, or sorry, anyone who claimed that the virus did not come from a wet market in China, but actually came, was leaked from the Wuhan Institute of Virology, was called a conspiracy theorist. Anyone who had qualms about getting this new experimental gene therapy, wondering if it's untested, it could cause bad health effects, was also slandered as a conspiracy theorist. And many people that I even know personally lost their jobs for refusing to get that vaccine. Now, several years, a presidential change, and a bunch of declassified documents later, we've got conclusive proof that basically all the concerns the conspiracy theorists have were completely warranted. We've got documents from the U.S. government showing that, yes, the vaccine did originate in the Wuhan Institute of Virology, and Dr. Fauci's inner circle was talking about it, saying that this looks like it is what happened. And he, Dr. Fauci in particular, abused his authority in order to like protect his reputation, because the U.S. government was funding some of this research at the Wuhan Institute of Virology to suppress the idea that it came from a lab and to promote the idea that it came from nature, and also to promote the idea that the vaccine was completely safe, even though now we're seeing more and more mainstream news outlets admit that there are, it was untested, there are blood clotting problems for those who received it, and many of the people who, in order to keep their job, got that vaccine, may be dealing with health problems for years to come. So that brings us to this week, because Dr. Fauci, he was actually subpoenaed before Congress 2 years ago in 2024, in order to testify about some of the rumors that he knew it leaked from the Wuhan Institute of Virology and deliberately suppressed the information. And now he claimed that that was all completely made up. He didn't know anything about that. He let the committees that were investigating this do their job and didn't try to pressure them in any way. Shortly after giving that testimony, Joe Biden gave him what is probably an unconstitutional pardon. He pardoned him for any crimes he may or may not have committed between such and such date and such and such date. He gave his son Hunter and several dozen other people the same pardon. I say that's probably unconstitutional just because while the U.S. Constitution does give the president the power to pardon you for anything, the strong implication is that he's supposed to say what it was you're being pardoned for. That, like, if Biden would have come out and said that, oh, Fauci is being pardoned for this crime and for this crime and for this crime and for this crime, the pardon could have held. Just saying, well, he's pardoned for anything he may or may not have done. It's kind of a legal gray area. But regardless, now that the Trump administration has declassified documents from Fauci's own diary proving that he knew the virus likely originated from the Wuhan Institute of Virology, proving that he was involved in the discussions to suppress the lab leak theory, and proving that he deliberately perjured or lied to Congress in 2024 when he said he wasn't involved in those discussions, Senator Rand Paul subpoenaed Fauci again. Now, because the courts are still upholding Biden's pardon of Fauci, we can't actually arrest him for perjuring Congress in 2024. That was within those dates he was pardoned for. We could potentially arrest him if he perjured Congress again after the pardon. And I feel like that's kind of what Rand Paul was hoping for. He kind of had Fauci in a unique situation where if he came to Congress and was completely honest about everything he ever did wrong, he'd wreck his legacy, but we couldn't prosecute him for any of it because it's back in the pardon time. But if he tried to protect his legacy and lied about what he did, then he'd perjured Congress again and he could be arrested. Dr. Fauci's lawyers saw that strategy coming a mile away and pretty much advised him to just plead the Fifth Amendment, saying you have a right to be silent, which he did 111 times. He spent hours in front of a Senate committee. He read an opening statement saying that he felt like Rand Paul was obsessed with him, he was being entrapped, and he was going to plead his Fifth Amendment right. And every time he was asked a question, 111 different times, he said, well, under counsel, I'm invoking my Fifth Amendment right to remain silent. They asked him what color his tie was, and he said, I'm invoking my Fifth Amendment right to remain silent. They asked him if he could see the manila folder in front of him, and he said, I'm invoking my Fifth Amendment right to remain silent. So he didn't say anything. And we'll see how that plays out, because Rand Paul's now trying to make the case that because admitting to his crimes wouldn't have implicated in him because of Biden's pardon, that he's still going to try to hold him in contempt of Congress for refusing to answer any questions. Maybe that'll work, maybe that won't. But it definitely, and our executive editor, Mr. Stephen Fleury, brought this out on his Trumpet Daily radio program, makes Fauci look very guilty. The fact that if he had nothing to hide, you could just come out and tell the truth. The fact that he's pleading the Fifth Amendment is an admission that he knows his options are tell the truth and destroy his legacy, or lie and go to jail for perjury. So he opted to plead the Fifth and not say anything, which at the very least I think is going to contribute to this paradigm shift I mentioned a few minutes ago, where I feel like the average person in America, unlike 6 years ago, no longer views Tony Fauci as the physical embodiment of science and this unimpeachable bureaucrat who's trying to stop a world pandemic with his lockdowns and mass mandates and stuff like that. I feel like most Americans realize that, like, well, anyone who pleads the Fifth Amendment 111 times during congressional testimony seems like he's got something to hide. anyone who's looked at the documents Tulsi Gabbard has released from his own diaries shows that, like, yes, indeed, he knew that COVID most likely originated in a lab where he was funding bioweapons research or gain-of-function research. That's gain-of-function is just when you take a natural virus and enhance it with a new function through genetic engineering. So you're taking viruses and making them more lethal. That's something with at least strong bioweapons implication. And the fact that in 2024 he said he didn't do those things, even though his own diary says he did do those things, shows that he is he definitely perjured Congress in 2024. So we're getting a lot of good information, not as much information as I'd hoped if he would have just ponied up and told the truth. But this is a big topic, actually, in Mr. Gerald Flory's book, America Under Attack. It's not so much in the main text, but there's an entire appendices to that book, Appendices C, about the COVID pandemic, particularly in regard to a prophecy in 2 Kings 14, 26 through 27 about end time Israel, in this case the United States, suffering bitter affliction to the point that the American Republic itself was on the verge of being blotted out. So God had to intervene in the course of human affairs. And even though the Supreme Court and the lower courts and the Democratic Party and the mainstream of media and the establishment were all conspiring to keep President Trump from regaining office, he had to intervene and help him to regain office, to temporarily spare America, give the American people an opportunity to repent and turn to God, and to expose basically how close we came to losing our country. And I do feel like you brought this up earlier that, like, wow, COVID at the time was like this existential threat where the government's doing lockdowns that probably aren't even constitutional. It's that you're not quarantining the sick, you're quarantining the healthy, doing things economically that were like right out of a Soviet playbook, using COVID as the pretext, normalize, and other English-speaking nations like England and New Zealand and Australia and Canada were even worse than the United States, doing things that were almost normalizing like socialist dictatorship-style tactics, getting the people used to this. And there was a lot of concern. It's like, well, is this going to be the new normal? Is the government ever going to surrender these powers? Is this just how life is now? And now most of those things have gone away, at least in part, I feel largely in part, to Donald Trump coming back to office. And so it is easy to just be, easy to breathe a sigh of relief and be like, well, we missed a bullet there, and move on with your life. But I feel like this testimony from Dr. Fauci, it does remind us of how bad things got, and also reminded us that it wasn't just an unfortunate set of circumstances, but this actually was, I guess whether the virus was leaked from the Wuhan Institute of Virology on accident or deliberately is a topic for the conspiracy theorists. I haven't seen convincing proof either way there. But the fact that this virus was intentionally developed using genetic engineering techniques invented by Ralph Baric at the University of North Carolina and taught to the Communist Party of China by Dr. Fauci and men in the U.S. government is been proven by extensive congressional research. And the fact that the government used the escape of this virus to lock down the economy and force millions of people to take an experimental gene therapy that probably has health effects, ill health effects we're going to be learning out from years to come, is definitely something that's been proven and that we are hearing more about this week, largely due to the fact that Donald Trump has returned to office and Senator Rand Paul has leeway he would not have had under the Biden administration to investigate and prosecute some of these scandals.
Yeah, it was kind of bizarre to get a look at his diary this week as well. I mean, I guess we got more from that in some ways than the hearing because, like you say, he just pleaded the fifth the whole time. You know, like the way that he'd have these entries that were like, X many people died. I'm so famous. Everybody loves me. I'm a big celeb. It was just, it was really odd to see that. And it reminded me of, you know, over here we had Niall Ferguson, initially known as Professor Lockdown, then became known as Professor Pantsdown because he lost his job for breaking his own lockdown rules because he was having an affair. And you know, he could decide what was best and what was safe for him, but everybody else had to submit to a draconian government telling them exactly what they could and could not do. And I think there were just more things about him that were just came out that were just kind of weird. Matt Hancock, another kind of person in charge of the lockdown here, just he went on reality TV afterwards and we got a good look at how strange he was. You know, these were the deities of our world that could do no wrong, that were worshipped by the mainstream media. And it somehow it's like, well, normal people, they're flawed and they have problems and they have, you know, you and I, we have weaknesses and we get things wrong and we do things that are weird and that are strange. And you can find me saying weird things on the show. But these guys, these experts, we have to do exactly what they say because they are the pinnacle of humankind and we must submit to them. And we've got a good look since then. And I think we got a good look at Fauci this week with nope. Trusting in experts means trusting in flawed human beings. And you know, that gets back to why on this show we're always like, don't believe me, believe your Bible. Here's an article you can go and read where you can turn to these scriptures. It will list some Bible scriptures that you can turn to and read yourself and explain and let you prove yourself. You know, we come on here and first of all, I don't think we really uphold ourselves as experts, but we also don't say trust the experts. We say prove it for yourself. And that was really missing in what we saw with lockdown and COVID. I mean, even improving it for yourself, like we say, prove it for yourself. Take care not to trust yourself. You know, you can be the expert that misleads yourself too. And we have to pray for humility and an open mind and to just get rid of our own biases and look at what the Bible says. So, you know, a good exposure at so many different aspects of the COVID pandemic this week. What else did you have for us from the English speaking world, Andrew?
Yeah, a couple other big scandals in the English speaking world. This one is one that amuses me. You actually wrote this up for one of our morning briefs this morning. I'd been following this story back when it was in the theoretical stage. Now it's moving into the practical stage where, with Zoran Mandani being the new socialist mayor of New York, he'd been promising to institute socialist-run grocery stores in New York. And I guess that's not just a campaign promise anymore. He's actually getting around to making it happen. The idea that, like, just groceries are getting more expensive across the nation due to increasing oil prices, lockdowns in Iran, other factors, especially in inner cities, theft is a huge price driving up grocery stores. Like, people steal so much from the shelves that the company can't just eat that cost. They have to pass it on to the consumer. And so many market things pushing the price of groceries up. Mandani's solution to that is, like, was like, well, it was like, we need public, like, city-run grocery stores that are not run for profit so that we can actually sell produce at a price that people can afford. That's his strategy. And we'll watch this story, and I will predict right now with 110% certainty that like a year or two from now, we will have concrete data of what an abysmal failure this project is going to be. Because you're breaking the law of supply and demand. The laws of economics are a lot like the laws of physics. Supply and demand are the two laws that drive price. If supply is high and demand is low, things will be cheap. If demand is high and supply is low, things will be expensive. So in this case, because of theft and increasing gas prices and stuff like that, price has gone up. So Mondani is going to artificially lower the prices to the stores he's running are actually losing money. And then they're going to have to get away with losing money by taxing people and then using that money, taking money from the rich, putting it in here to redistribute from the poor. But if you bring down the price, the way the laws of supply and demand, it's like the law of gravitation, it always works. If the price goes down, demand will go up, supply will stay the same, and you'll get shortages. That's why you have bread lines in communist nations. And so this is a new thing. So if a lot of you probably figured that out for yourself or read it somewhere else, but if you haven't and you think Mondami's plan is a great idea, you heard it here first. I will be back on this show in a year or so with conclusive data about how there's food shortages in Mondani's socialist grocery stores in New York.
We should have some kind of official, like, I am going to eat my hat live on this show, or
yes.
Some such commitment.
I don't wear a hat, but I'll make that promise. If we get 2 years into here and like Mondani's socialist grocery stores are a smashing success that have brought prosperity to inner city New York, I will buy a hat and eat it.
It might end up being a hat made of fondant, but I think you're pretty safe in the. I actually brought this up in kind of an unusual context before we had you on. I completely agree.
Yep. And then two other quick stories while we're on the topic of socialist and Democrat scandals. Joe Biden's ghostwriter revealed a lot of his recordings this week, showing that when Biden took classified documents home, there was a scandal about a few years ago, he knew they were classified and was even admitting on audio tape that he wasn't supposed to have these. So that's another scandal that we now have, similar with the Fauci diaries, proof that he wasn't just a senile old man that took some documents home that he knew he wasn't supposed to have. But he actually admitted at the time that he knew he wasn't allowed to take those documents, took them anyway. Also, some new revelations about Joe Biden's Secretary of Immigration or Homeland Security Secretary, showing how that under his watch, there were many illegal immigrant children that went missing that the Biden administration lost. Some investigative journalists have dug deeper into that story. And found out that many of those missing children were sold to sex trafficking rings in the United States. So new scandal this week that Biden's Secretary of Homeland Security knew that children were disappearing from his internment camps and didn't really do anything about it, showing that it wasn't just the fact that the Biden administration inadvertently lost migrant children to sex trafficking rings, but looks like they even knew this was happening in real time and either turned a blind eye or facilitated it. That's another topic. Whether they facilitated it or turned a blind eye to it is an open question, but both are pretty bad. the fact that they did nothing to stop the fact that they're letting millions of illegals in the country, knowing that many of these children they let across the border were being sold into human trafficking rings in the United States.
Well, thank you very much for that, Andrew. Thank you to everybody who joined us on this show. You can get all the material that we mentioned on our website, thetrumpet.com, as well as any past shows. We have a whole wealth of books and booklets, and we have our free Trumpet magazine that comes out 10 times a year. You can sign up for that at The Trumpet. Make sure you get that in your letterbox every month with tomorrow's news today. I mean, we've been quoting from articles that we wrote or that Mr. Flurry wrote months ago that have just been proven incredibly detailed descriptions of what we've seen play out since then. So don't miss your opportunity to get that magazine, to watch Bible prophecy fulfilled before your eyes. Well, thank you to all of our panelists. Thank you to Victor Granados for engineering and production. If you have any questions, any comments, you can get in touch with us at trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. We'd be very happy to hear from you. We'll be back with our regular show on Wednesday next week. Until then, keep watching your world.